You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the absolute pleasure of speaking with a former student of mine who is no longer, well, he's always a student because we aren't we all, but Aaron Whalen, who was a student at the school I co-founded and was head of for years, New Road School, and is now, now you are the, let me get this right, you're the executive director of Da Vinci Schools.
Da Vinci Rise.
Yeah, Da Vinci Rise.
Yep.
Okay. So, and is that more than one school, or is that Da Vinci Rise?
So it's one LEA, so one local educational agency. So it's technically one school, but we have three campuses across the county. And then Da Vinci Schools is a larger charter school network housed out of the Wiseburn School District. But Rise is specific and unique, and we are under the County Office of Education.
So you are a charter?
We are a charter.
Okay. And so could you, well, first let me ask you, you know, when did this, it's more than an urge, it has to be to do your job. So when did this passion emerge for education, not your own, but for doing something about education in your community, in the community?
Well, was that,
were you born with this? Did you grow up thinking, you know, I want to be a teacher when I grow up? And they're like, what?
Absolutely not. No, I wanted to be a performer growing up. I wanted to be a dancer and an artist. But I think, that's a great question. So I would say originally, when kind of coming to education, it came with a lot of anxiety and also a lot of joy in some interesting ways. But I would say, like, as a young person, specifically middle school and the beginning of high school, I really struggled with reading. Like, I had a terrible experience with reading. I would, like, get into cold sweats when it was my turn to read. I would practice when, you know, it would be like, each kid has to read a paragraph. I would count the numbers of kids in the classroom and then see which direction we're going and count. And then I would practice my paragraph until it got to my time. And so,
the teacher would switch and give
switch two, it up. Yeah.
One kid two paragraphs. It was like, oh no.
Yep. And then there's that
process. You're talking to me. You're talking to my experience exactly.
Yes. There's that process where you're reading and then you stumble on words and then the teacher corrects you and everyone has to listen to that process happen over and over. So it was just, it was a really scary experience for me. And then it wasn't until I read Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry that I actually fell in love with the process of learning through written language and kind of like the reading process through New Roads. And all of the work there and the amazing, and then ending up in AP English and falling in love with literature and storytelling and history, I then became an English teacher. But I think the reason for that is in undergrad, I was a anthropology major, and I originally thought I was gonna go through anthropology to being like a lawyer, to law, and realized that was not my path and that was not what made me excited. I wanted to be closer to the communities I would be serving. So Teach for America quickly recruited at the school that I was attending at Grinnell College in Iowa, actually. I was a Posse Scholar there. And they got my interest immediately because I realized I'd be able to work in a unfamiliar community with the people who I believe are the lifeblood of the community, which are youth. And so, took on teaching and wasn't sure how it was going to go. But I started my first day in the classroom as a 20-year-old from LA in Miami-Dade in Florida.
Oh, wow.
In an entirely Haitian community as
like
Afro-Latino kid. Yeah. So just like experiences that were so unique and different, which I think I love. Once I stepped in the classroom for the first time and saw the power you can have with working alongside like the youth of a community and what you could do for the future, I never looked back. And I think it brought a lot of circles together, right? Like I knew what it was like to be a New Road student and the power of like people investing and loving you through your story, through your learning. But to do it as an active educator was a really like beautiful process and also healing from some of the fears that I had early on in the game, like I shared with learning.
So you were not an eager elementary school, middle school student.
No, I knew it.
You were an eager student, but it wasn't all roses and daisies.
I was always an overachiever. and so I'd always do my homework and I'd do extra credit and do everything I possibly could. But when it came, you probably wouldn't know how nervous I was in class. A lot of my teachers the biggest thing I used to get in trouble for was talking a lot. Like to people around me and wanting to like have conversations. So I wasn't necessarily quiet, and I definitely wasn't apathetic. I was very like engaged and wanted to do well. But I think that most of my fears were under the surface. So like you wouldn't be able to see how scared I was to read, but it would keep me away from books in general on my own time.
And did the urge to work with people who are frequently the least fortunate in a community come from the experience in various communities, or did you grow up with it? Where did that come from?
That's a great question. There's a lot of layers to that, so buckle up on that one. I would say in the beginning stages, my family structure is really that of like a ton of different experiences. So my mom's side is from Gomez Palacio, Mexico, but my grandmother was white passing, and then my grandfather was Native American. And so like very dark skin, they had very different lived experiences. So I grew up with that understanding in the household. And then on my dad's side, we're from Louisiana. He was born on a plantation. And so that left our family in a very interesting place. My grandmother brought property when she moved from Mexico in her teens in Santa Monica, not knowing the tourism and wealth that Santa Monica would one day become. And so our family's been there for over 100 years. So that led to a very sheltered and privileged experience for like me as a kid growing up, because I was the only immediate like family that lived in that home and was there with my grandmother and my parents and my aunt. But then I had family that throughout LA lived in places in LA, we call it the jungles, which is like Culver City, east of Culver City, you know, areas in like South LA. And so they experienced completely different connections, specifically with like state funded entities like schools.
Did you know that you were at least financially privileged growing up, or
I don't know if my parents would even call it financially privileged. I think we were more like situationally privileged. Like I could walk out and be a young, you know, brown, black kid and be safe. I was in a place where like I had all the access of like safety and security, and then got to go to amazing schools because my mom knew about the amazing schools that were offered, and she knew about, you know, finding opportunities for financial aid. She also knew about volunteering at the school so that you were, you know, a true asset and that they would always believe that you and your child should be there. So all the things I really attribute to her. But I think when I say that, the reason, because that question was so great, is I've always grown up in a place of like polarity where it was like, okay, I've been experiencing this, but then my cousins from other parts of LA would come and live with us during the summers. And like, that would mean that we were doing like our summer homework together. And I would see literally the differences in like what I was in my schools and what they were doing. And also the ways that I was affirmed in my schools for asking questions, thinking critically, pushing on the mark, but then the things that they were punished for as Black women for doing the same thing, right? We're being raised to be completely different occupancies in society, right? Like literally I'm being told to be like an entrepreneur, a critical thinker, a change maker, and they're being told to be complacent, compliant, and a worker amongst peers, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that I started questioning it then.
Can I stop you for just a moment and say, the blur that you have on, the background blur, is distracting, and I think it's going to be distracting in the final cut. Is there something on the wall you wish wasn't there?
No.
Okay. Everyone belongs. Everyone's different, and everyone belongs. There it is. Doesn't get much better than that.
So that I would say is like my personal why. I think larger than that is first year of teaching, 20 years old. Jump into the classroom. I think I have from the more I spend time supporting teachers and like getting into the work, I realize how rare my experience was. But my first year of teaching was like amazing. It was so joyous. I had such a good connection with my youth. I think it was because I was so young.
What grades were you teaching? What were you teaching?
All middle school, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. Two of my sections were for supporting students who were behind, and then one of mine sections were for students that were advanced, based on, of course, state assessments. But Miami public school, huge, like thousands of kids. And I think being so young and being in education and then having models like New Roads, right? Having teachers who were encouraged, which is rare as well, now that I'm a school leader, seeing that, is encouraged to be themselves and bring themselves entire selves to the table and all that, what that encompasses. I knew nothing else. I knew nothing different. Because Grinnell College is also an incredibly amazing institution, a liberal school, everyone brings themselves. So yeah. I didn't have a lot of the holdups that I think new educators do, where it's like, who am I supposed to be? And then they emulate like sometimes teachers in the past that may have been problematic, or they emulate what they think they should be. Mm-hmm. I just was who I was. And I think the kids gravitated to that. So, you know, supporting with, you know, conflict in the classroom, behavior, teaching and learning, like all of that came very natural. And the kids just, there was times where I would take in other people's classes and off record, but on record, because we're doing this now, like there was times where I had 60 to 70 kids within, because I had the science lab, and they would place them in my classroom when people were out instead of hiring a sub, because there was such a strong culture that the kids respected the space and I respected them. And it was really powerful. All that to say, in that first year, I told myself I was going to do something new and different for kids that I think was amazing. Haitian culture is incredible and beautiful and filled with music and dance. And I think it's so liberated from some of the like gender norms that we have in American culture of like who dances and how. And so I like fell in love with that part of the culture the second I moved to Miami, moved specifically to North Miami. And so I started a dance group because I've been dancing my entire life. And there at the very same time, a little boy came into the classroom, into my English classroom through the advanced English class, and he was mute. So no one knew why. He would look at you and for me, it never came off as rude. It looked as if he could not speak. He would just smile at you. He would nod. And so all that to say, when I put off the audition flyers for the dance group, I was incredibly surprised when he was in the back of that audition line and wanted to try out. He came alive. Like when he auditioned, he just like came alive. It almost was like time stopped. And just all of the auditionees, the students, like everyone kind of saw this and heard this student's voice for the first time. He ended up becoming a co-captain. So we had youth captains. And so he ended up becoming a co-captain to the team. He started to speak slowly to myself, to my co-captain on the leadership end, who was the
scientist. He always could speak.
Always could speak. Yep. Always could speak. And it was only for the first few weeks at the school that he didn't speak. Yeah. And I'll share with you why we found out why. Mm. But and then he started to build relationships within the dance group of kind of folks that he could trust. Over time, as he kind of a few weeks, he started to be in leadership positions, started to have a lot of ownership. He started to help choreograph dances and all of that work for our upcoming shows. I started to realize that he was absent for multiple weeks at a time. Like he would be absent for days, sometimes the end of the week, the beginning of the week. And so I started to ask him a little bit more about, you know, what was going on and how I could be a best support to him. One thing he shared was that his family went through housing instability quite often. So they would often apartment hop, couch hop. And when that would happen, they were often placed in relatives or friends' homes outside of the Miami region. Right. And with that, he was the oldest of the kids. And so he would have to take care of them. And he was often the least prioritized in terms of getting to school because the younger ones, it would be more important for them. So that was one piece. And then he also shared with me his kind of journey to our school. And it was that prior summer, he came out when he was very young, he came out to his family, which is incredibly brave in a Haitian community, specifically a Catholic Haitian community. His dad took to that poorly and sent him back to Haiti that summer, told his family that he had not met yet, his family in Haiti, that is what happened. And to that experience, he went through all of the abuses pretty much in the spectrum. It ended in a terrible way, and his grandmother ended up having to fly down and come get him and bring him back to where she lived, and which was Miami. Mm-hmm. So he came to us in selective mutism because of the drastic trauma that he had faced over that summer. And so I think once his spirit could see a safer place, he began to unravel. But I think it was very mm-hmm. meaningfully kind of enclosed. All that to say, as a 20-year-old, like a young person, I didn't even think about like all the legalities of what it means to like jump into a kid's life. So when dropping him off, which I did often from rehearsal, I went into his, I knocked at his door and I spoke to his mom. I had spoken to her on the phone many times. There was a language barrier. She spoke Creole. So I had just started to learn little bits of Creole to be able to communicate. But I asked her, I was like, so Card, share a little bit about, the challenges that y'all have faced. I would be honored to support him financially to pay for, you know, meals and make sure he's an amazing attribute, you know, attribution to our dance team and our English class. And I would be honored to house him because I lived with the other co-captain. She was a science teacher, and we had this huge living room in between with a comfy couch and food in the fridge. And so I basically said, you know, we're all three of us are going to the same places in the morning. It's zero inconvenience to us. And he's a true joy. We could help him with his homework. You literally have STEM and humanities on each door. So, you know, to my surprise, because I honestly, the more I think about it now, I'm like, that could have gone left. It could have gone right.
It could have gone so bad.
It could have gone so left, right? Like any school, like leader knows how bad that could have gone. Yeah. I didn't think about it at the time.
Good for you.
She, with like tears in her eyes, was like, you know, thank you. This is a blessing. And I thank you for investing in my child. Thank you for wanting to provide stability for him in a time when our family's struggling so much. And so I'm never more grateful for a person than, because I now as a parent, which I'll explain later, but like I see it, like, well, how much that probably took to say yes. So over the 5 years that I was in Miami, he became.
So you were in the program for 5 years. You were in.
Technically, Teach for America is 2 years, but whole goal is that people keep teaching. So I kept teaching. So he became a huge part of my family. My parents would fly down, you know, 2 to 3 times a year, and I would go home. But more importantly, they would come to Miami. So my dad taught him how to swim. My mom and him always talk about how she was his first therapist, and so like they became just as much family as I was with him. And as time went on and I continued to grow trust and relationship with his mom, I had some conversations with her about what that would mean, with my parents and with her, about like what adoption would mean. Because it was clear as time went on, he went through a lot of challenges, continued to go through housing instability challenges. Also, his parents weren't necessarily accepting of either parent of like his identity. And so there was a lot going on there too. So continue to kind of keep the conversation open. I would say, you know, from any bystander, I served as parent during that time. He really lived with me most of the time, but also really worked in tandem with his mom and really wanted to support there. But so long story short, he did amazing things, did beautiful things. Towards his junior year of high school, I was getting placed on principalship pathways, right? So it was like, okay, like let's look into dean, let's look into your credential. And I knew from what I had seen in Miami, it wasn't a place where I would want to be a school leader. I think there's so much beauty and value in being able to be consistent for many years, as you were. And like that level of just commitment to a community, I think is so beautiful and so important. It's something that I wanted to emulate that I had been able to experience in your leadership. But my experience in Miami was that they move, especially in the public school system, they would move the principals based on area of need. So it'd be like, oh, you know, David Bryan's doing an amazing thing with New Roads, but there's a school over here that's struggling, move him. And he's going to solve it, right? And it's going to be this like turnaround mentality. And I thought that was so problematic because I had 4 principals during my time there. And so what would happen is there was this like internalized anger from the teachers. Many of the teachers that I got the chance to learn how to teach with had been there for like 10 or more years, which is like such a rarity in the system. So I, you know, there were teachers that had been there literally since they were in their 30s and now they're in their 60s and they just like have committed and they've graduated entire families. But then I get a new principal every 2 years, right? And I'm just like, that's so problematic. So I knew that I didn't want to do it in Miami-Dade. So I
a new principal and new, either new approach from the principal or new school policies that come down that whether the principal wants to or not feels obliged to implement. And it is frequently, sadly, it is frequently an uncomfortable and unfortunate situation.
Yes, exactly. And I think it is. And I think what I saw happen authentically is like there's a level of like, I don't want to call it guerrilla warfare, but that's how it kind of felt like where like the teachers shut their doors and do their own thing because there's so much transition outside of the doors. Sure. Right. And I think many of the amazing educators at North Miami that taught me some of my best lessons in the classroom were those teachers. They were like, there's going to be a new principal next year. Like, close the door. This is how we support with this. Like, do not send your kids anywhere when they're you know, misbehaving, quote unquote. Like, this is how we handle it in a restorative way. Like, I learned some of the biggest things that I think that like make me who I am today. Because they're like closed door, no nonsense. Like, we're not going to do what this new leader.
That sounds like a really lucky placement for a young teacher.
Oh, such a lucky
happen up into a place like that. That's great.
So lucky. But all that to say, I ended up moving back to LA to teach for his senior year and some of his junior year. But I told him and I talked to his mom.
And he moved with you. Wait, were you?
He did not at the time. No, he had to finish high school. he had to finish high school. And at that point, he had started his own GSA. He had like truly found his bearings, just like such an outstanding person and amazing leader in his school. But it was hard. I mean, during my year and a half that I was back in LA, he was placed into a shelter at one point. So I was continuing to like send, you know, financial support, but that's nothing, you know, nothing changes that experience. But what I told him and his mom is that, you know, when he graduates, like we're going to get him into a school and he's getting in dance was a passion. So we're going to get him to a school for dance. LA has American Music and Dramatic Academy. It would be a dream for him to do that. So we ended up, you know, I supported him with his audition tapes and interview and all of that. And he ended up getting in. So our signing day was actually his graduation day. And so me and my family flew down to Miami to sit alongside him and his family, shoulder to shoulder. We all cried and watched our little boy graduate. And then we went to dinner and, you know, had some festivities. And then me, my mom, my dad, my aunt, and Sicard all flew back to LA, where he started his first day in the following week. Yeah, at American Music and Dramatic Academy. But yeah, he graduated. He's doing amazing things. He just had an Abercrombie campaign come out last week where he's like talking about pride and the power of like being who you are and like sharing his experience. He was just featured on a podcast a month ago.
Is he in Los Angeles?
He's in Los Angeles. Yeah.
He lives in LA.
He lives in LA. He's successful. So I think for me, you know, I co-founded Rise with Carrie Croft.
Yeah. So tell me that. Tell me that story. Yeah. And if it helps along the way to try to, so Rise is a member of Da Vinci School, mm-hmm. and Da Vinci is one of the, what do they call, XQ schools or no?
No, I can, yeah, let me decipher all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so sort that out for us.
Yes, so Da Vinci Schools is a charter network, really designed.
It's a charter network with how many, you say one school, but several campuses, yeah?
No, nope.
Well, that's Rise.
So Da Vinci. So that's Rise. So Da Vinci Schools is like a charter CMO, like a charter for office.
A management school.
They have several different schools. So they have specific like schools focused on different career paths. So they have Da Vinci Science, Da Vinci Communications, Da Vinci Design. They have Da Vinci Extension, which is like a career college and career program. Da Vinci Connect, which is a homeschool hybrid. So they just have a lot of like amazing different options for families in the South Bay region. Mm-hmm. Carrie Croft, who is Rise's founder and Rise's kind of co-founder with me, but she connected with Matt Wunder, who is the superintendent of Da Vinci School.
Of Da Vinci.
And so Carrie and I worked together through Teach for America to train teachers. And so she was often like a school leader and I would be like one of the coaches that would train the teachers. And we had a lot of conversations about students like Sicard. A lot of this, she worked in East LA. So a lot of students that she was serving that she felt like the school system was actually working against, not for. And so, you know, really a lot of the things that I did for Sicard, I was told actively not to do, right? But it would have led to different outcomes, right? Like don't give gifts or pay for things because it's favoritism. Like when students are missing school, like get on them about attendance, don't support them and ask why. Like, so all that to say, that's how we were connected is Karen Croft and I worked for Teach for America together. She was connected to Matt Wunder, who's the superintendent of Da Vinci Schools. And so Da Vinci Schools is again, kind of charter network of schools designed for project-based learning, career exposure, like career college and career exposure and readiness, and mastery-based grading, all about like growth mindset and not just you're an A student, it's not, or you're an F student, it's the learning process. So when that connection occurred, you know, what came to mind is that like these are the things that often students like Sicard, students in the system, students in whether it's foster care, housing instability, probation, are often not afforded, right? Many students in those situations are given packets and told to complete them, and then it's a credit, but there's no actual discussion, learning process that goes on, versus which was the opposite of what I experienced at New Roads, right? And so we thought it would be an incredible opportunity, and so did Matt Wunder, the superintendent, to make a school specifically designed with the, you know, the empathetic center being the kids who have the least, versus I think most of our schools are really designed for like that standard, like two-parent household, this like median income and like kind of stability so that we can just do school. What if we designed a school that was for kids who can't just do school because that's a privilege, but who have to do all these other things, whether it's be a young parent, you know, go through and meet with their probation officer. What does that look like?
And that's you're now speaking about Rise schools.
Rise. And so then we founded Da Vinci Rise, which is one of those schools now. But Da Vinci Rise, our model is that we co-locate with nonprofit organizations And so we have small learning centers across the county. So the one I'm sitting in now is New Earth, right, which is an amazing diversion program, Learning and Leadership Center for youth who have maybe touched the juvenile justice system. But I think the beautiful part is that the nonprofit is built with that in the heart of it so that it can serve kids who have been impacted by the system. And it can also create amazing programming and systems for kids who haven't.
And so are these separate? So just for clarity's sake, maybe I'm too far in the weeds and just tell me to shut up. But the kids who are at New Earth, are these the same kids who are going to RISE?
Yeah, so RISE has three campuses, each of them with a nonprofit. So New Earth is where I'm sitting right now in Culver City.
Nonprofit kids, the kids who are there for the nonprofit are also there for RISE.
Yes. Yes.
So what's the nonprofit's role in what you guys are doing at?
Yeah, I can give you a high level. So we have three. So there's RISE at New Earth, RISE at a place called Home, which is in downtown LA. Richstone Family Center, which is like a family therapy center. So I'd say all of them are different, but I would say New Earth is probably our like model partnership in terms of how we interact with one another. Like as we speak, I'm sitting here with like the head of our education partnership, and her name is Evelyn Diaz, who's like, I'm sitting here in the office with her. Like we work in tandem. The whole vision behind the partnership is that students don't see the separation between folks who are working with them, specifically in this case, like on diversion or staying out of probation or amazing like leadership programming, and their teachers. We did empathy studies with youth in the system or youth in other systems, they were often saying like, it's almost like the mom and dad divorce complex. Like I'm hearing one thing from one parent, I'm hearing another thing from another parent. One parent wants this for me, one parent wants this for me, but really it's about what they want because they're adults and not really thinking about me. So it was like, we kind of had to figure out like, what does it mean for the school partner to be really aligned with the nonprofit that's like, you know, supporting the family or supporting the kid, as well as attorneys, probation officers, you know, social workers, all the other people on the team, to be one like continuous caregiving force. And so all what you'll see if you come to a RISE campus is you'll see our nonprofit partners working alongside our educators, working alongside our mental health team to support kids holistically. And it really becomes like a beehive of just like support and services versus the kid has to go from their school to then go to New Earth for their like diversion programming or for like their, you know.
Does it at RISE, is it the case that when you walk onto the campus, either there with where you are right now at New Earth, or the other place called Home, does it feel like people are walking into a school, or does it feel like they're walking into something else?
Oh, good question. Definitely, I don't think it feels traditionally like a school. I feel like it probably feels, I don't know what it feels like. I think it's interesting because all the services are integrated. And the space where learning happens is really vast, but it's not traditional. It's not that you're not going to find like classroom A, classroom B, classroom C.
The kids show up, they behave as if they're going to school.
They do. Yeah. I think the only thing that
I don't mean behave like stay in their lane. I mean, I mean like, you know, the place is saturated with learning of all sorts.
I think so. What I would say the biggest difference is that instead of behaving like they're going to school, they're behaving like they're here to learn. So like some of our students will come in and it's like they need to meet with their case manager first because they're like have something going on at home, or they have some more. They like understand Maslow. They understand they're coming here for like Maslow's full hierarchy. They don't. Yeah. They're not coming for the like self-actualization top tier that's super cute. Like adults really want to have a stay in as if like. Kids don't need our help with anything else. So it's like they're actually like, okay, like I actually am here today, but I have worked a graveyard shift and like I'm actually exhausted. So realistically, right, like a lot of us are like, okay, well, let's like get you a cot, take a nap, we'll see you in 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and then you'll be ready to learn. But I think so often they're used to, and that of course takes trust, right? Sure. Often kids are used to like, if I'm hungry, it's my problem. We think of it as like you're hungry, you're part of our family, like we're gonna feed you and then we're gonna and then we're gonna like help teach you. So I think we try to encompass the whole Maslow's hierarchy versus just the top.
Fabulous and brilliant and wonderful. So kudos.
Thanks.
Yeah, that is terrific. And is there an urge by RISE to expand? Wait, your role at RISE is what? I looked at the website, hard to find anything.
I know executive director is such an interesting term anywhere. But I support and lead our leadership team. So our principal, our assistant principal, and then our coordinator of student support services, who's over like the mental health wing. I oversee the organization writ large, but then it's like board management, fundraising, grant writing.
That's you as well.
External relations, yeah.
And what does, or Carrie, did you say Carrie was your co-founder?
Yeah, so Carrie is the co-founder, but Carrie actually has, no longer works at Rise. She just actually graduated last week from USC for policy, her master's in policy. So she's moved into like the political sphere.
Mm. I get it, sorry.
Yeah, that's actually a common trajectory for Rise. It's like folks come to Rise, they work with us and devote a good amount of time, and then they realize all the systems that are working against Rise to work well and like the problematic things that we do in policy or in, you know, just in just government and where we put our funds that are actually working against kids who are already disenfranchised
and do you
go do that. So like, we've had like our original manager of student support services, who was an incredible, her name is Cherokee, over like she was a MSW and did therapy with kids. She now works at Children's Law Center to like get into that level of like the work. So I'm frustrated, and I think the school is threatened by the inability for folks to admit the amount of resources that youth need to overcome things like foster care, housing instability, or the probation system. And so what I currently am fundraised per capita for per kid is half of what I need to fund the program we provide.
And where does that funding come from? Where does the supplemental funding? So there's the what you get from, you know, the maze called charter school funding,
right.
and then you supplement it with a big chunk. Clearly,
with a ton of grants. Yeah, a ton of grants, grant writing. We're a community school now from California, so that provides some additional funding. But it's literally like we're unable to see more than like 2 years out because we're just consistently fundraising for the services that we provide. And I think what has started to grow up some traction is assembly members, state appointed officials coming into Rise and being like, this needs to happen everywhere. And then I show them like the fundraising and like all the fundraising I do to provide the social worker, case manager, therapist, psychologist that they fell in love with and saw the services they provide.
Yes.
And then they realize like, the funding formula is broken for schools, right? Because if we could just have one counselor for all of our kids, then we wouldn't be serving the kids that we're talking about, right? We'd be serving the kids who don't need a counselor. So then you get like 12% that do. That's the toughest part of my work is the fundraising, is trying to get that, continuing that with enough fidelity. And then right now, just the political piece, getting the assembly members what they need to like delegate budgets to us for the services.
So if you're willing, could you talk a little bit about like how long did it take you to get the school idea that you had, you and Carrie, to get that off the ground? What was the design process like? And how'd you arrive at maybe you think of it as a model. Is it a model that could be theoretically replicated, whatever that means?
Yeah, so Carrie and I were so young, and I would say Carrie really started to concretize the vision when she was at Harvard. And so she started, often in school leader master's departments, they have you do a petition. And so Carrie really used the ideas that she had been thinking about, that me and her had been collaborating on, around a school that could be designed for kids who are often written out of that narrative, right? The larger educational narrative, which are the homeless, foster, probation population.
Sure.
And so she came out of that work at Harvard with her master's with that kind of drafted. So then we basically heard about XQ Super Schools competition, which was Lorraine Powell Jobs and Russell Nully worked under the Obama administration education. These two powerhouse women created the biggest all-call in history to rethink education. And their whole pitch is like, we have seen so much change in the last 100 years, but we haven't seen education change. Where kids, predominantly are still sitting in rows or reading from textbooks. They're trying to do like rote memorization, even though we have smartphones in our pockets that can do the same thing. So they basically were doing this amazing political stance, like switch, change the way we're thinking about it and have people begin to submit petitions. And I thought it was beautiful because they actually said, like, you don't need to be in education at all to submit. Like, any dreamer who has an idea, because we've all been through school in some sense, like has an idea of how it can be better, submit. And they took it through a whole design process. But the most important to RISE was the empathy interviews, because we brought youth in all those systems together around a table and asked them, like, what's working, what's not working. Let's talk about, and then from every system we talked about, attendance, let's talk about literal class time, seat time, let's talk about projects, let's talk about learning, let's grades. And how does
these
that-
were, and this is, these were interviews, conversations with the kids of the population that you were seeking to serve.
Exactly. With them as like the centralized vision builders, right? And so what they, and so with that, you know, we got to a lot of things. We got to like flexible scheduling is one of the most important things, because they don't have the privilege to just be like, I'm just a student now. And I can just, my 8 hours of the waking day are just going to be like focused on that without getting any income, without getting any, like any more stability, getting any closer to a hot meal. So we had to think about that. We also realized that the nonprofit partner piece came from like, there's so many resources that I need to get to point A, which is like school, like the learning piece, like to sit down in this math class and to be able to be ready to learn. I may not have been fed. I may be exhausted. I may have gone through trauma where I need to like actually be de-escalated in my mind because of the things that I've gone through before the night before. So we realized like, we're not the best people to do that. And we're also not the first people to know that people need it. So why don't we go to nonprofit powerhouses across the county and partner with them so that they can do this work with the kids. And then most nonprofits are pretty vacant in the day. And they're more active when kids get out of school. So theoretically, right, a lot of the nonprofits that we saw in the county are like, their spaces are open. So it's perfect. Let's put a high school in the daytime and then you can do your nonprofit work with the other communities in the evening. Yeah.
Just footnote that New Roads originally opened up in the Boys and Girls Club of Santa Monica because it was empty during the day.
yep. Exactly that. Yeah. And then having a mental health team was super important to us in the community, because a lot of our kids, the people who have, for many of our, especially our foster youth, we might be connected to them via a social worker who's only worked with them for 3 months, right? That happens a lot, where it's like, I'm actually the oldest relationship that they have in their team, but I've only known them for a year, or I've only known them for, you know. And so what would it mean for our kids to have the same therapist that RISE for the 4 years and like have that historical knowledge that you would hope a therapist would be able to have on something? And then we submitted this petition, this large, you know, 1,000-page document, to the competition, and just kissed it and wished it well. And we ended up hearing back, and they brought a camera crew and all of the bells and whistles of a large nationwide competition. And they shared with Carrie and I that we had gotten, and the founding team, that we had gotten the $10 million grant for the first 5 years to found. And so that took our vision from a dream. I was still working at another charter network in LA at the time. Speak to my school leader, quit my job. And we took off that next June with our first family of kids. It was 3 students. Then we got to 12 in the next week, and then got to 40 the next week. But we started with our first group of students. One of the youth who was the original family we started with ended up joining us on staff and becoming like a youth advocate and leader in our community. And before moving to Vegas, now she's in Vegas living a happy life. But that's the XQ connection. And XQ has really been more than a funder. I'm going to see them tomorrow in the Bay, but they've really invested and involved in like the progression of the school and believe in RISE as a model for the nation. But really, I think about like best practices for doing the empathy interviews to start a school, less than like you. I love the way that you were interrogating that, right? Like less than just like, this is going to work everywhere. That's not a thing. Right. But the right questions to ask that will get you to work where you are.
Yeah. And not you, I know you've thought of this, but is there potentially more support from XQ or
financially
not? Financially. I mean, because I think one of the things, not that it's, you know, hey, I'm not telling you your life, but I think one of the challenges always is the challenge of finding the funds and to have sort of inspired, insightful school leaders who have a feel for education and a feel for what's needed here, having to devote so much of their time, energy, effort into searching for dollars, you know, it's not that it's terrible, but boy, better spent perhaps elsewhere. So,
absolutely. Yeah. So XQ has already, especially in the challenges of the pandemic, we went through a lot of challenges. So we opened up our New Earth site that I'm at, right? We opened up that during a time that was hold harmless. So basically charter schools are not paid for increased enrollment. So we opened up a brand new site that we had already agreed to open up, that we wanted to open up, that we knew was important to open up during a time where we were no longer gifted additional funds for those students. So XQ, along with Balmer and other powerhouses, stepped in and got us through that, financially got us through that time. So they've already, you know, yeah. And they consistently pour into our school leaders and our school. So I'm going to a neuroscience convention tomorrow to speak about like trauma in the brain and learning. And so they just are always looking for opportunities to share the work we do, which is already going to bring in more funds.
That's great.
They're definitely a lifelong companion and friend.
And can we talk a little bit about the sort of the education piece? So there's mm-hmm. there's flexible learning. Flexible scheduling.
Yep.
And you know, one size never fits all. We all know that. Except with really bad socks, baby. But there are sort of baseline needs that people, educational needs that people sort of need to get to as they bump into the world. So, yeah. So how does RISE approach that? I mean, is it graduation standards, the same graduation quote standards and requirements? Is there an assumption that everybody's going off to college? And how that's probably too many things in one question, but you're a smart guy, you'll figure it out. But how do you guys think about success? What is a successful education?
Yep. Yeah, we play in the sandbox that we're in. So we know the backtracking and the work we need to do to ensure that our students' experience is palatable. I think that my experience in like Montessori schools and really amazing institutions like New Roads and different, like we have the privilege and the assumption is that the families have the privilege to be able to push the mark more than maybe students who have zero kind of institutional support or familial yes. support or you yes. know financial support. So we know that. But what we do is there's three really good questions in there. So I'm gonna try to remember them. But one, in terms of the learner's journey, we're competency-based. So what that means really in layman's terms is that we're all about skills. We're not about, I don't want anything that I can find here. Like I don't need my kids to memorize the things that they can find on their own, but I do need them to be able to take in the information and do everything they need to do with it. And a lot of that, I think the brilliance of that is being able to unsilo content areas. Whereas mm-hmm. a lot of the times our kids come to us and they're like, oh, I'm really good at like reading in history, but I'm really bad at reading in English, or I'm really good at writing in, you know, in this class, but really bad. And it's just like the fact that you feel that way is a testament to schools right. following your brain as if that's how the world works. Right. So we always encourage our teachers, which is also a good part of the nonprofit partner, is pushing our teachers to work together to create holistic projects that push the thinking around all those content areas. And then also, if we're really here talking about learning, then our students should be able to make progress towards that learning and graduation, whether they're in a classroom with a credentialed teacher or they're doing authentic learning with a nonprofit partner who's doing like a leadership course or a gardening course, and mm-hmm. or they're out in the world doing interviews with, you know, various business owners to get a job. So we're also working so many of our students have been disenfranchised. It's very common, especially in like the juvenile justice system, for kids to be enrolled in schools and like the camps and to be doing all kinds of stuff that keeps them well-behaved or busy, but not be told until they're out of the camp that they didn't earn a single high school credit for that. And so they're no closer to high school graduation than they were before. So our job is to do the opposite of that, is to say everything that you do that's learning and authentic and you're doing revisions and reflection is learning. And we're going to do the translation backwards to make sure that it connects to all the different content areas because it's already real. Many of our students come to us and they're like, I've taken English 9 three times because I've moved states or I've moved homes or I've moved regions or schools. And they keep starting me from the beginning because it's really messy for adults to do like half credit. Or it's really hard for a teacher to be like, well, we already read Othello, like you can't read it again, or you can read, you know, so it's like everyone gets stressed, like as if their life is so hard, they can't do anything to modify. So we tell our, you know, we promise to do the opposite. We're gonna say like, okay, you were in, you know, this school, doing English 9 for this long, tell us about what you read, tell us about what you got. Let's do some like baseline assessments to see where you're at with your reading level, your literacy, you know, where you're at. And then let's meet you there. So you're starting from month 5, not starting from day 1 as if you wasn't qualified because, you know, adults don't want to backtrack.
Right. Right.
So I think that's a lot of it. I think there's two other questions you might have asked.
And well, let me stick one in there. So Does this mean that that RISE needs a lot more teachers than most schools? I mean, is that, for lack of a better way to put this, right? Is the teacher-student ratio different at RISE than it is in many other places? Because it takes a lot of time, energy, effort to create all that stuff for called curriculum, called projects. There's an urge and an effort to make it fit this kid, that not all kids, but these kids. And so is everybody wrung out, and you know, at the end of the day or the end of the week or the end of the year, like you are right now. But so is it super labor intensive for teachers and students?
I've been in education long enough to never say that anything is not labor intensive on teachers. I would
good
rather never that right. Rather not be burned at the stake. But yeah. I would say we would definitely love to have more educators than we do. We have our school sites are all micro sites, so we don't have any campus right now that's over 100 students. And so it's because of level of care and love that they need. And often when people come, they're astonished. They're like, "Oh wow, there's just as many adults here working that as students." but I think it's also because we're holistically supporting kids, it's what people don't see from surface level is that just because there's 30 kids on campus because their individualized schedules bring them to campus at this time during this moment, it doesn't mean that the other 70 kids are not being supported by the case managers, the site directors, the workplace. It's not like we're holistically supporting, because if high school could just be high school, it wouldn't be the population of kids that we're serving, right? To get them there means we have to take care of the rest of their life as well. We have a humanities teacher, a STEM teacher, a special education teacher at every campus, and then we'll have a traveling science teacher. So, I would say we could do more. We could have more, but the nonprofits help too with a lot of the programming that we can't have in-house, so like art.
And is there an urge to grow? I mean, do you wish you could have, instead of 100 kids at any campus, like 200 kids, or are you,
no.
Do you see the wisdom of being small? Yeah.
No, 100 is a lot. 100 is a lot when you're thinking about like the ways that
100 is plenty.
The way that society has like challenged these young people and like the work, the wrongs that have been done in many of their lives, like 100 is perfect well-oiled machine and a staff. But
well, there's something spectacular about everybody knowing everybody else's face, everybody knowing everybody else's name, and their parent, and their, you know, because it's a nice, you know, it's a nice number. It's not crazy.
Yeah. Right?
So that's brilliant. But there is a desire to grow in the numbers of sites, I take it, because that will serve more kids who are, you know, there's no shortage of kids in that sort of need, sadly.
Yeah, the vision is to create really like a web of care, so that if a student is transient, does move homes, does move regions of the city, there's another RISE that can pick up with a nonprofit, well-resourced nonprofit that can just like continue where they left off, because so many of our kids kind of start over so many times. Mm-hmm. And so that's the vision behind the mini microsites all across. It's almost like a Y, like a YMCA, right? Where it's like, you know that there's one local, a kid could go there and get what they need. There's love and support there. They all speak the same language. It's the same interface and system.
Right. That's great. If I knew what I was talking about, what would I have asked you?
That's a great question. How do we mitigate the school to prison pipeline is what you would ask me. And I would say that we specifically recruit and support youth who have been expelled and suspended from other schools. And we are a non-suspension, non-expulsion school because we do restorative justice. So everything we do is about like, just like a family would do restorative justice, right? Like, you're not going to throw your kid. Well, I say that with like a level of the knot in my throat, because I know this is not the case, but theoretically, because I'm speaking to David Bryan, you wouldn't throw your kid away because they're misbehaving, or because they're mad that you and your partner got a divorce, or they're mad because you lashed out at them before in your moments of stress. But I think often because schools are so limited in their resource and sometimes capacities with human power and people and money, they have gotten to systems of like punitive measures, right? Where it models and it mirrors like the justice system that we are in as adults. And so, so much of what we do, even speaking to the human capital part, is love and invest in our kids, right? And have the, I can't tell you how many conversations Evelyn across the desk from me and I have had with youth and their families, right? Like, we're not going to give up on you, but this has got to change. Let's talk about it. Let's have meetings. Let's have conversations. Let's set up plans. Let's reset up plans. And why does privilege dictate how much you'll do that, right? Like, I think when I think of like schools, like I was so lucky to go to an amazing school like New Roads, but it's like that restorative process is ingrained, right? But then innately, that's like there's more value in that community because of all these different factors, and the families are the ones that are funding the program. And so what does it mean when the families can't fund the program and they're part of like a more like, you know, generic system of your serving community? So it's just, we want to provide our kids with what their affluent counterparts get in terms of like a love and care and affection and getting to try over and over again when you didn't do it right the first time.
And have you ever, you know, I'm not seeking dirt. I'm really trying to understand this, but have you ever had to make the decision to ask somebody to leave the school because it just, whatever,
it just couldn't fit? Yeah. So of course, like number one for any, like all of us, right? Like the biggest thing is safety. So we've had situations where a student got in a conflict with like multiple students in a day, like a physical altercation with multiple students at once, and got into like that point of heightened extent intensity. It got to the point where we were supporting him. He had experience of like gang involvement, you know, the probation, all of those things. But we were working with him at another campus, like separate from those students, and doing one-on-ones. But literally, like teachers in our program were leaving campus, including me, leaving campus to support him for a few hours to do one-on-ones just with this one student, because we believe every single student matters. But it got to a position where that was unsustainable. And so we had to talk to his team, like, do you think that he's in a place where he can go through the full restorative process? That's a lot of responsibility, like to apologize, to go through the process. Like, and they and him were like, he's not there yet. And so they found him another placement. And so that's probably the closest we've had. What we do often is move students across our three existing sites. So like a student has a huge challenge with like maybe one population of students in this area, we move them to like another campus.
I have this question that I like to ask people, but that is, you know, who do you admire? And you already told me who inspires you is your son, which is delightful to and what's your future?
Oh, that's a huge question. I don't know. I know for me, the biggest thing is a commitment to RISE and the work that we're doing until we can be sustainable on public dollars. And I think that could be a lifetime sentence, or that could be a year long sentence. And I think that for me is like, I've invested so much love, blood, sweat, and tears in the community. And they've also invested so much love, blood, sweat, and tears in me, that I would be remiss to change that relationship until I know that, like, without my fundraising, because I've been fundraising my butt off for like the last 2 years to make sure that we're good, without that, they can still stand on their own and it can be a model. Once that happens, I think that I would love to make larger decisions for like the region, like more superintendency level decisions and support to like do right by all kids by centering the kids at the margins. So that would be the longer term goal. But
well, Aaron, I almost don't want to stop having this conversation just because it's so delightful both to speak to you and to also see who you are becoming. The way it's played into your personal life, there's a clue there, right? I mean, so you ended up adopting and essentially helping to raise this young person. And was, you know, in some ways a very large part of his pathway to success, or in the direction of success. And you mentioned it before, you know, that treating kids at the school as if they were your family, and that means, you know, it is only under extraordinary circumstances that somebody in your family gets cut off. Rare that somebody can be thrown out of a family. Well, you know, is that person not getting education now?
Right.
Are they done? I mean, really? We're just that's it. You know, they're 14 years old and they're done. And the willingness of so many people to say, well, yeah, they should be done. They should not be able to be here. I was like, oh, that's not the kind of place that makes sense. It's not a place that cares about people, especially people that you bring in, right? And it's like, so,
yep.
So good for you. Good for you. So, hey, thank you so much for being willing to spend time and talk to me and do this wacky thing.
What a full circle moment.
It's great. Aaron, you take care. Oh, thank Shelley, you. Shelley, my wife, says hello. She remembers you.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, please talk, yeah. Say hello.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.